You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Paved paradise, put up a parking lot. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot.
1970 was the year of the first Earth Day, the same year Joni Mitchell wrote her environmental lament, Big Yellow Taxi, about paving over paradise and putting up a parking lot. When Joni Mitchell sang about paving paradise to put up that parking lot, I'm guessing she wasn't thinking of pervious cement, pervious concrete, a more sustainable type of concrete already in use all over the country. Water runs right through it. Yes, it's sturdy enough to pave parking lots and driveways, but so porous it looks just like a Rice Krispie treat. So rainwater trickles right through it down to the ground below rather than running off and flooding storm drains and sewers, and also allows you to actually feed the trees that may have roots running down there and all kinds of stuff underground, returning the water. There are other sustainable paving ideas out there, too, like cement that sucks up greenhouse gases. Or if you got that sticky gunk left over from making biofuel, why not use that as a binder for roads rather than asphalt? My next guest can answer those questions and many more about the brave new world of pavement. Joining me to talk about these technologies are Cheryl Sullivan, Senior Landscape Architect at the Cunningham Engineering Corporation in Davis, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks.
Hi there. John Harvey is Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California at Davis. He's also Director of the University of California Pavement Research Center. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon.
Now, Cheryl, I saw that demonstration. We have actually on our website at sciencefriday.com, we have a video of all this water pouring through the pavement. How does that work?
Well, how does it work? Well, the difference between regular concrete and pervious concrete is that pervious concrete doesn't contain any sand. It just has cement, rock, and water in it. So all the little rocks are coated with this slurry and then put into a form and tamped down, and all the holes remain. Now, pervious concrete will have anywhere from 15 to 20% voids or air pockets within it. So that's how the water drains through it, and it goes into a gravel base underneath.
Is it being used in many places?
It's being used all over the place. It's been in Florida for over 30 years now. It's used up in the northwest, or northeast and northwest. So it's in cold country and dry country and wet country. Mm-hmm. It's, as my grandma used to say, it's the best thing since sliced bread. It's just amazing stuff, but it's so simple.
Yeah. Is it strong enough, though, to be used as highway paving, for example?
We don't use it in highway paving. It doesn't take the high traffic speeds. It will ravel off. The little rock pieces will be spurred off with the high speed. It's used in parking lots, driveways, low-speed alleys, like in condominium complexes or apartment complex, or even in these the urban infills where we have a lot of low-speed alleys. And then school grounds can use it. Hospitals are using it. It's all over the place.
How much water, can you give us an idea, can go through this stuff?
Sure. A piece of pervious concrete can have 400 inches of water pass through it in an hour.
Wow.
So it doesn't clog. So
even if it got coated with grime from the road, you know, from car drippings and things like that?
No. Say in Seattle. Seattle, I think the highest, their highest rainstorm is like 5 inches in 24 hours. So even if 90% of the concrete were blocked up, you know, someone had dropped sand in it or dirt or gunk, it still wouldn't be, you would still have enough storage capacity and enough perviousness for that water to not stay on the surface of that parking area or that roadway. So it takes a heck of a lot of stuff to clog up a pervious pavement.
Right. John Harvey, can it then act as sort of a reservoir and store any of that water?
Yeah, the idea, there's two things that you design the pavement for. One is the hydraulic infiltration, as Cheryl was talking about. And we've actually, and the second thing is the structural capacity. Up to now, mostly folks have been putting it down just for cars because, as Cheryl mentioned, it hasn't been designed for the heavier trucks. We've been doing some recent calculations and some research where we tighten the mix down a little bit, make it not quite so permeable, but able to handle a lot of the storms that we have, and then increase the structural capacity. And we're looking at some potential applications of retrofitting the shoulder of the roads so that then they can carry some trucks. They can't carry the high speed, but maybe you can carry some low speed trucks. And then that pavement, if you put water in it, has been looked at as a way to cool the environment, cool the local environment down around the pavement due to the evaporative cooling.
So you might just actually not wait for the rain, but you might spray water on the on this pavement, and it just evaporates a little bit and cools it off.
Yeah, as a colleague of mine was talking to him earlier today. You know, that's an old technology used around the world is toss some water out on the pavement, and you get the evaporative cooling effect. There has been some research done by the Public Works Research Institute in Japan, where they've been taking the irrigation water from the medians, the landscaping in between, in the middle of a boulevard, and dropping that water down into the pavement in the late afternoon, and then getting a pretty substantial evaporative cooling during that peak heat time.
I'll tell you, we have this posted on our Facebook at Sci-Fi Facebook page, and we got so much response from this idea. Yeah, it's just it's amazing. But people were worried about it clogging up. They're worried about, will it freeze? Will it, would expand if there's water in there? Will that expand and break up the pavement in the winter?
I think that I'd like to add one thing to what Cheryl said is also besides pervious concrete, there's also pervious asphalt. There are pervious interlocking concrete blocks. And we actually have our parking lot at our research site. We just have gravel, and it's fine for low volumes of low-speed traffic. There's been some research at the University of New Hampshire that has looked at some, and also I believe Cunningham has done some work in, and some other folks in Pennsylvania, some other freezing environments, and it has not been a major problem from what I've seen because the water actually is down in the gravel, which doesn't really have that big a problem with it, and down next to the soil, so it's
right. It all depends on the soil mix and the what the geotechnical engineer says has to be the depth of the gravel below. But when it's designed properly, there isn't the cracking, the freeze thaw issues that you have with regular concrete. Because as John was saying, it just the water melts and flows down into it, so the rock isn't coated with water. So it's great for a parking like in Denver when it snows. It starts to melt. The parking lot's dry. You're not left with these icy puddles that you have on a regular or conventional asphalt or concrete parking lot. Mm-hmm.
And what happens if there's a gasoline or an oil spill? Would it just sink right through into the ground? Or
yeah, it would. That's why we don't recommend putting it in gas stations, because if you do have a spill like that, you're going to have to take it out and remove it in all likelihood.
Kind of the way we've thought about that, particularly for if we're going to be retrofitting a shoulder of a highway pavement, what happens now when there's a gasoline spill? A lot of it runs off the road and runs into the soil on the shoulder of the road. So in a way, we're actually capturing it in that shoulder or in that pavement. And then there is as long as you're not going to affect the groundwater, we've been talking to some of our environmental engineers that a lot of the bacteria, as long as you capture it and hold it there, it may not be as big a problem as you might think compared to the a regular pavement.
Somebody sent us a note saying that in their neighborhood where they have it installed, it has to be vacuum cleaned once a month to get the dust out of the pores.
Well, typically they recommend vacuuming once or twice a year. Perhaps some people may be overly concerned about clogging issues. If you do have this open matrix that dust can fall through and then gets deposited, you have 6 inches of concrete and maybe 6 or 12 inches of gravel underneath it. unless someone is dumping, you know, a truckload of sand or soil on top of it, it's not really going to clog it.
All right. Now we've talked so much about it. How can you get your own?
Well, I would certainly recommend that a person, if it's a homeowner, that they hire a contractor who has been a certified pervious concrete installer, because there is a special way to do it, and if you don't do it correctly, it won't work or work as well. And there are a lot of contractors out there now, concrete contractors, who are certified in the application of it. So you can't go down to the local Home Depot and pick up a bag of pervious concrete mix.
That was my question. And John, are there any newer types of paving material that people are looking at?
Well, one of the big questions in the paving world is the quest for what we call the third binder. Mostly we use for binders in pavements in the surface area asphalt or cement, and asphalt coming from oil refining has a lot of environmental considerations, impacts, and cement also is basically the burning of limestone, which also produces quite a bit of CO2 as well. And so the quest has been for a third binder. There's a lot of work going on right now. Some demonstration projects, things like growing algae and processing the algae to try and extract an asphalt-type binder using vegetable-based binders. I've even seen one paper about using pig manure, but I'm not for each. And then in the cement area, there's a new type of cement which is there's a company in California that is demonstrating how to capture the CO2 out of the flue of a power plant and then process that using salt water and some other really innovative chemical processes, and they can produce aggregate, they can produce what we call supplementary cementitious materials, and even some types of cement from that. So they're actually taking the CO2 and out of the stack of a power plant and converting that into road building materials.
Wow. Wow, that's so, it's not a boring topic watching the road dry.
No, it's a terrific topic.
All right, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Art.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Cheryl Sullivan, Senior Landscape Architect at the Cunningham Engineering Corporation in Davis, California. John Harvey, Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California, Davis.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
That means it's time for this month's episode of Science Diction, where we explore the origins of scientific words. With my guest, Howard Markell, is a professor of a history of medicine at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. Welcome back, Howard.
Hello, Ira. How are you?
Hey, what word have you got for us today?
Well, I got a word that I know is near and dear to your heart, radio.
Ah, very near and dear to my heart, yes. I hadn't thought about where radio originated.
Well, it's a great word, but it originates from a type of electromagnetic radiation or waves that propagated through the air.
Right.
It was discovered by the physicist Heinrich Hertz in 1888. So around then, radiation or radiant energy referred to a lot of terms, radioactivity, alpha, beta, gamma, and X-rays. And in 1888, he named his electromagnetic or radio waves that traveled across the ether, which was the atmosphere, at the speed of light. Now, today, we measure units, frequency units, in hertz or megahertz. But back then, in 1888, he said, "My discovery is of no use whatsoever," which was probably the greatest understatement in the history of science.
Huh. So when did it get, linked to the kind of radio we sit around and listen to?
Well, there's a technological step in between. Around 1893, first Nikola Tesla, and the following year, Guglielmo Marconi, and then several others, developed conductors and transmitters and receivers that made it possible to send electrical waves, and then Morse-coded electrical waves, longer and longer distances. By 1901, world news was that Marconi managed to send the letter S in Morse code across the Atlantic Ocean.
Right.
That was big news.
Big news.
Yeah.
Important.
Yeah. So after that, Other people started working on frequency waves that carried the sounds of voice and even music, and that was called radio telephony or telephony. But the point of those things is that they were really communications between two individuals. I'm going to talk to you on the phone, or I'm going to send you a radiogram, which is what those telegrams were called.
Email,
right. Literally email, the original email. But what became the radio, as we understand it, what we're on right now, was based on a whole slew of inventions and creations and discoveries and many historical actors, which is so common in the history of science of any, you know, very complicated device. And by the way, broadcasting, I can't help but tell you that that's an agricultural term, and it meant casting your seeds broadly across a large field. So that's an agricultural term.
Right.
But there were many, many people involved, as I said, and three in particular stand out. The first is a man named Dr. Lee DeForest, and he was a gadgeteer and inventor, and he invented the Audion, which was a glass vacuum tube with prongs that could receive distances, radio signals from long distances. But he didn't know how he invented it. He patented it, but he didn't know why it worked. And he got involved in a lot of fly-by-night businesses and lawsuits for the rest of his career. But another genius was Erwin Howard Armstrong, who between 1912 and 1927 discovered the regeneration circuit and the superheterodyne, which allows us to dial in frequencies and hear them even better. And he even discovered FM, or frequency-modulated radio.
Yeah.
And then the final great man in the history of broadcasting is David Sarnoff, who began working as Marconi's messenger boy, was the telegraph operator when the Titanic was sinking, so that was very lucky. And he founded RCA, which created all
there
these radios and later televisions, and even he created the National Broadcasting Company to put on shows and entertainment that people would want to buy radios for.
All right. And as they say in radio, we've run out of time, Howard.
Ah, nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Howard Markels, professor of the history of medicine at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, also director of the Center for the History of Medicine there. As I say, we have run out of time. You can also surf to our website because there's some great videos up there. We have the teenagers who created this terrific wheelchair. It's a video up there. And and also, if you wanted to see the pavement, this porous pavement, the pervious pavement, and how well it works, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Both videos up there for you guys, everybody, to enjoy. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Google now draws over a billion visits each month to its websites. It's also the target of a massive antitrust investigation by federal regulators. As NPR's Nina Gregory reports, when it comes to policing monopolies, it's not the size that matters.
It is not illegal for a company to have a monopoly. What experts say is illegal is how a company uses its monopoly.
Have they unfairly excluded competitors in a way that will hurt consumers?
Bob Land is a director at the American Antitrust Institute, a nonprofit research group. He's watching the Federal Trade Commission's investigation of Google closely.
Google has this enormous power, and they have the incentive to unfairly exclude competitors in a way that could harm consumers. And the FTC wants to see whether this has happened.
It will be a difficult case to make. The site is free to users, Google says, and if you don't like its results, you can go elsewhere for information. And despite its dominant market share, Google argues it doesn't have a monopoly. There are other search engines like Bing. But most important, it says the FTC's notion of search is antiquated. Matt Cutts is a software engineer at Google and explains that search is no longer relegated to just search engines.
You can go online and ask your friends, whether on Twitter or Facebook, you know, hey, I need a recommendation for a good bicycle or something like that. It's not probably always going to be about the web. It might be, you know, bringing in things like social. It might be bringing in trusted experts.
Gary Reback is an antitrust attorney in the Silicon Valley. He's credited with spearheading the government's massive antitrust case against Microsoft in the 90s. He says in the case of Google, the government is also investigating whether the search engine unfairly puts its own results at the top. For example, say you Googled map of Pasadena. A Google map might come up above MapQuest.
The allegation is that Google brings its own results up to the top of the search results, making them more visible and more valuable than competitors who actually would score higher on the normal relevance tests Google uses to rank search results.
Google denies that it tips the scales in favor of itself. One of the many companies that disagrees is the online travel company Kayak.com. Robert Burge is the company's chief marketing officer.
We believe there's a very compelling case that Google is abusing its dominant position in search to stifle competition and to extend its control over how information and commerce flows over the internet.
He offers an example. Say you want to go to Tahiti.
I think what would happen, you know, if you search for hotels from Tahiti, you're going to see a number of search results that appear to be unbiased search results from the Google search engine, when in fact they're part of a new product that Google has launched in the last year that's their own product and is based on what advertisers are paying them.
Google admits companies are sometimes unhappy with where they turn up in a search result, but not everyone can be first. There are myriad accusations being made against the company, and given the scope, the FTC probe is ongoing. Similar cases have taken years to sort out, but in this Google investigation, the FTC certainly has plenty of data it has to search through. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
What do you do with the monster you've created when you no longer know how to manage it? Well, perhaps you sell it. That's what the parent corporations of ABC, NBC, and Fox are considering to do with the online television service Hulu. Hulu gives people free access to network TV shows over the internet, where the networks can still sell some advertising. It attracts some 27 million users every month. It's a monster. And now the networks are getting scared of the threat it poses to their traditional business model. Dawn Chmielewski writes about the business of online entertainment for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert.
And first, Dawn, what's the problem that ABC, NBC, and Fox have with their successful offspring, Hulu?
Right. You wouldn't think that that media companies that had created such a successful online offering would find itself in a quandary here. Here's the basic problem. The networks created an offering that is so successful that it's creating tensions with the rest of its businesses. NBC and Fox and ABC all provide programming that's distributed by cable operators and satellite companies. And that is a lucrative business. The fees from the cable operators alone is something on the order of $30 billion. And here's the rub. Hulu, while it's growing, is providing the same sort of programming that one might find on their cable channels or on their satellite provider. And there's some fear on the part of the cable operators that perhaps Hulu's offering is so good that people will cancel their cable subscription and just watch Hulu for free. So this has created an internal conflict between the media companies and their business partners who built this very large and mutually lucrative business of television.
So if I wanted to look at a Law and Order rerun, I could go to Hulu and watch it the day after. But as I'm doing that, I'm undermining some cable channel whose format is Law and Order reruns.
Well, let's be clear. Now, Hulu provides the current season's programming. That's what makes Hulu different from a lot of the other online offerings. Hulu allows me to watch popular primetime shows as quickly as 24 hours after they've been initially broadcast. Now, the cable operators are saying, hey, you know, we'd like to hold on to our subscribers, and we would like to have the ability to offer that sort of catch-up, the ability for our subscribers to catch up on an episode that they missed. We'd like that right. So therein lies the conflict.
But in a way, they would be saying, here, Hulu, if they decide to sell the service, having launched you, we're now going to take the part of your competitors, actually, and help out the cable channels that you've been wooing viewers away from all this time.
Well, the media companies see this perhaps as an opportunity. When Hulu was created, the online marketplace was a realm where people were watching short-form videos of dogs on skateboards, right? Mm-hmm. It hadn't been demonstrated that people would sit at their computer or indeed at their other devices and watch a full hour of television. And Hulu was the proof point. With the demonstration that audiences were willing to do that, a market emerged. So the media companies may see this as a moment to set Hulu free and sell its content across multiple distributors. This may be a moment for the media companies to find a way to make money out from not only from the distribution that Hulu provides, but also some other competitors in the digital marketplace.
Dawn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's Dawn Chmielewski, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, who covers how technology is changing the entertainment business.
This is NPR.
To China now, where the government gave journalists an early look today at a new high-speed rail line. It cuts the travel time between Beijing and Shanghai in half. The line will be formally unveiled later this week to coincide with the ruling Communist Party's 90th anniversary. While the project's construction was remarkably fast, it was by no means smooth. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports, the effort has been dogged by allegations of corruption and fears that it will never be able to pay for itself.
This was the inaugural press run of China's Beijing to Shanghai high-speed rail. This train line is not just a technological achievement, it's also being touted as a political one, too. The chief engineer of China's railways, He Huawu, was on the platform, and he's been saying the timing of this launch is no coincidence.
This is China's pride. We built this railway in 39 months. Such a high-standard railroad is a gift for the 90th anniversary of the Communist Party.
In this showcase project, nothing has been left to chance. Even the beaming train attendants are uniformly cute. Gao Dan is the chief train conductor. I ask her if it's true the attendants are picked for their looks. She giggles and thanks me, blushing. You'll see that all the train attendants are very beautiful, she assures me. Then the train door shuts and the train glides off almost silently.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Beijing.
The cheapest ticket on this bullet train will cost $60, and it travels at a top speed of 186 miles per hour. Critics say the tickets are too expensive, and the poor will suffer.
I'm now sitting by the driver's cabin, which is separated from the rest of the train by a clear glass window. Now, this trip from Beijing to Shanghai is about 820 miles, and it takes 4 hours and 48 minutes. To put that in context, it's slightly further than the distance from Washington, D.C. to Chicago, which on the U.S. train system takes 60 hours and 40 minutes.
This train line cost $32 billion and was finished a year ahead of schedule. But how much of the technology is actually Chinese? I asked Zhang Guotang, deputy GM of the Beijing-Shanghai High-Speed Railway Company.
Everything under our wheels is Chinese technology. The rails, the bridges, the tunneling, and the control system, the software, is programmed by us. So I can say we've grasped the technology of building high-speed rail.
However, this project was plagued with corruption, with Railways Minister Liu Zhijun sacked for disciplinary violations amid rumors about his numerous mistresses. During the construction of this track, $121 million disappeared. Then there's the debt problem. The debt-to-asset ratio is almost 60%, and some believe the money from fares will never be enough to repay those loans.
I think the debt crisis of municipal railway is very serious in China. It's more serious than the subprime crisis in America.
Railway expert Zhao Jian at Beijing Jiao Tong University. He gives the example of one particular line from Zhengzhou to Xi'an. Built to run 160 pairs of trains a day, it currently only operates 12 pairs.
Operate a railway is similar to operate a restaurant. This just a restaurant has about 160 floors, but at present, only 12 floors in the operation. The others are empty. So this kind of restaurant will face very big problem of debt crisis.
We've now arrived in Shanghai and it's been an incredibly smooth and pleasant journey. In many ways, this high-speed rail project sums up what's good and what's bad about modern China. It's undoubtedly a technological feat, building such a huge spiderweb of high-speed rail lines across so much of the country in so short a time. But it's saddling the government with massive debts. It may never pay its own way, and it's permeated by high-level corruption. It's breathtaking in its achievement, but it's also flawed. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Lots of people have given up trying to find a partner through parties, bars, dates, work, neighbors, friends, laundromats, bus stops, coffee shops. And they've turned to online dating sites where there's lots of choices and where they'll maybe, maybe not, find a good match. Online dating sites and how they make their matches is the subject of the article Looking for Someone in the current edition of The New Yorker by my guest, Nick Palmgarten. If you're wondering if he looked for his match online, the answer is no. He's only been on two dates in his life, and on the second, he met the woman who became his wife. They've been together 23 years. Nick Palmgarten, welcome to Fresh Air. So you have an image I really like. You basically say that online dating is serving the function for middle-class adults that college serves for younger people, because when you're in college, you have a really large pool of single people that you can meet. And then after college, that pool keeps getting smaller and smaller as your circle of friends shrinks and as many of them get coupled off.
Yeah, you run out of friends, and then you run out of friends of friends of friends. And, you know, what internet dating provides is a much bigger pool. And with that pool, you know, theoretically, you have a better chance of meeting someone better. It also means that it takes a lot of work, you know, to sort through all the possible mates that are there for you.
And it means you're making choices based on information as opposed to making choices meeting somebody and having a feeling about them.
Right. It's not just the look or even that one thing that someone says or a feeling that you have in that moment. It's, you know, a written and curated presentation, you know, the dating profile, you know, that tends to favor someone who might write well or be clever. But I guess the idea is that you are reverting in a way back to an older way of dating or of getting to know people, which is you get to know a little bit about them before you meet them, which has an almost kind of, you know, 19th century feel to it.
Let's talk a little bit about how the online dating services work. They all have slightly different theories of compatibility. So why don't you choose one and tell us their theory of compatibility?
I spent time sort of with three or four sites. One of them is eHarmony, which is probably the squarest of the bunch. It's the one that is most overtly committed to finding you a spouse or a partner for life. And their approach is based on some clinical psychological findings that say that, you know, compatibility is important, that the idea that opposites attract is a bit of a canard, that opposites attract, well, they also attack. That's the term they use. So what they try to do is they try to identify, you know, personality features that make people compatible.
Now, they actually have a relationship lab that you visited. What happens in the relationship lab?
Well, the cool thing about the relationship lab is that it's run by a husband and wife team, sort of a Nick and Nora of relationship research. What they do is they have married couples come in periodically and go through a bunch of tests, you know, little exercises, and they observe those exercises and look for clues to the kinds of things that would indicate that these are happy marriages or less than happy marriages. I mean, they don't do a lot of judging on scene, but they do pick up on little cues. You know, for example, if a husband rolls his eyes when his wife says something, that's a sign of contempt. And apparently contempt is not a good emotion to have in a marriage.
So in the eHarmony relationship lab, they're trying to find successful couples and figure out what it is about them that makes them a good match,
right?
So that they could duplicate that in people who are looking for a match?
That's the idea. I mean, to a certain extent, I sometimes wonder if there's a little bit of Potemkin in the enterprise, that they want to be showing you that they're doing this as much as the fact that they are just doing it. But the idea
is you mean to make it seem more scientific?
Right. I mean, you know, all these sites, they all have an approach that they abide by, yes, but the approach is also their selling point. But they are trying to figure out, you know, they're trying to find a secret sauce. Another site is chemistry.com, and that's owned by Match. And Match started it actually in response to eHarmony. And, you know, they've identified personality types. They have, you know, four personality types, an explorer, negotiator, builder, director. And these are, you know, these correlate to brain chemicals, neurochemicals, dopamine, estrogen, serotonin, testosterone. And, you know, they feel that there are certain compatibilities in their matrices of compatibilities that better indicate which two people might get along better and have a long and happier life.
Did you take the test to find out which type you were?
I did. I mean, it's hard to resist a test, and I found out I was an explorer negotiator.
And what does that mean? What does that mean?
I think it means that I'm, I'm daring, but I'm, I'm willing to take on all kinds of crazy adventures, but at the same time, I'm very respectful of others. I think these are all flattering categories, by the way. It's sort of like your horoscope. It's always telling you things that you want to hear. But the funny thing is that I took the test, and then I had my wife take the test just for fun, and it turned out that I was one of the, the 10 people that was recommended for her. So I'm one of her matches on chemistry.com.
I mean, of all the people, she didn't ask for you. She just put her personality in and you came up?
Right. And it wasn't even my real name because, I didn't feel comfortable going on with a real name.
So there's hope for your marriage after more than 20 years.
Yeah. But she didn't come up as one of my 10, though. That's
Oh, she didn't?
No. I can't. Oh,
you
I came up,
you
as,
came
one
up
of
as one of hers, but she didn't come up as one of yours.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how that. Maybe that's because I'm an explorer. I don't know.
Right. Okay. So chemistry.com is owned by Match.com, and Match.com is one of the big ones. You said that Match.com takes stock of your stated and revealed preferences. What does that mean? What is the equation that they're doing?
Well, most sites begin with a questionnaire. Match is no different. You answer a bunch of questions describing who you are and describing what you think you're looking for. But what they've found and what other people have found on these sites is that your behavior online, who you click on, who you receive messages from, says more about you often than your own answers. And what they do is they figure out that there's sort of a disconnect, a dissonance between your stated preference and your revealed preference. And they sort of they plug both of those into, the computers, and the algorithms figure out what it is that you really want and how the distance between those two things is indicative of a certain type of person who wants certain things, and they go from there and figure out exactly who your perfect match is.
Can you give us a sense of what the questions are?
Well, the questions are all over the place. I mean, some of them are pretty basic. The questions about yourself, obviously, you describe yourself. You describe your what you do, what your values are, what your religious beliefs are, all that kind of stuff. And then correspondingly, what you're looking for. This other site, OkCupid, has their questions are basically provided by the users. And what they have is they have questions that seem totally nuts, but they've found that there are correlations between seemingly mundane questions and deeper, more important revealing tendencies. For example, they found that the question of whether you'll sleep with someone on the first date, right? That's not a question you're going to ask someone if you're about to go on a first date. But apparently, the question of whether you sleep with someone or not on the first date, the answers to that question correlate perfectly or nearly perfectly to the question, do you like the taste of beer? So if you say you like the taste of beer, you are also the kind of person who says, yes, I will sleep with someone on the first date. Another question they
could
found—
Could you stop and say that makes no sense to me? Because most people like the taste of beer, but a lot of people wouldn't sleep with somebody on the first date.
I was surprised. I thought that maybe people are more honest about the taste of beer in the questionnaire. I mean, I don't know. But another good one is, do you like horror movies? Apparently, if two people both feel the same way about that, they have a better chance of getting along. Like it's a very revealing question about compatibility. And when you think about it, I don't know. I've sort of informally done a poll, and it seems to bear out anecdotally. Do you like horror movies?
Well, I'd have to say, which kind? Are you talking about horror movies from the 80s or classic horror films like Frankenstein and Dracula? Are you talking about, Val Lewton movies or splatter films?
You're taking the fun out of it.
No, no, but that's the thing. I can't do questionnaires because I
had the same problem.
I always do this whole, well, what do you mean by that?
They're really binary.
Yeah.
They're really binary. And, the political questions seem sometimes simplistic. The religious questions seems simplistic. I sometimes felt inspired to write little essays in the box they provide, which have no bearing, but it's just, and then you come across like a pedant, I'm agnostic, but let me explain that, I'm not going to get any dates that way.
I remember the first time I knew somebody who had looked for a partner or a date through a personal ad, and this was God, really, this was in the 70s. And it was somebody who did it through, like, the New York Review of Books. And I thought,
right.
Wow, that is just so weird to do a personal ad. And he really, I think, loved the person who he met. And they were together long distance, on and off for some time. And it's so common now to meet people that way. It just, not necessarily through the New York Review of Books or through like an ad in hard copy, but through some kind of service like that. It just is so interesting how the landscape has changed and how common it's become.
If you were to do, you know, a straight history of internet dating, you know, you'd have to go back and look at the New York Review of Books and their personals as sort of a watershed thing, because they made they took it out of the sort of the back alley and they made it into an art form, the profile or the classified ad. And, you know, that strain sort of continued on in Nerve.com later in the, you know, late 90s, and it's still going. You know, the idea of the clever, well-curated personal profile, which is very much a part of it. I mean, you know, Facebook and that kind of thing also contributes to that. But, you know, those old ads in the New York Review of Books were important.
Well, Nick Palmgarden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nick Palmgarten's article about online dating sites is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to his article on our website, freshair.npr.org.